Hello and welcome to A Health Podicy. I'm your host, Alan Weil. As my guest today notes, perinatal mental illness is a leading cause of death during pregnancy and the first postpartum year in the United States. If addressing perinatal mental illness is a priority, do we have tools other than screening for it, diagnosing it, and treating it? Well, one option is to move upstream and cultivate well-being among the people whose mental health we seek to improve. That sounds good, but what would it actually mean? How can we improve perinatal mental health by building perinatal well-being? That is the topic of today's episode of A Health Podicy. I'm here with Allison Stubbe, professor in the Department of Maternal and Child Health at the Gilling School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina, and a maternal fetal medicine subspecialist and professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the UNC School of Medicine. Dr. Stubbe and co-authors published a paper in the April 2024 issue of Health Affairs examining how an approach focused on well-being can improve perinatal mental health. We'll discuss that approach in today's episode. Dr. Stubbe, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm looking forward to speaking with you about this topic. We come at this issue, and much of what's in the April 2024 issue of Health Affairs is about diagnosis. You diagnose an illness, you come up with a treatment plan, and you treat it. And your paper discusses a different way of thinking about this, which is to focus on perinatal well-being. So let's just begin with, if you would, you helping me understand why is it important and helpful to approach the topic of perinatal mental health from the perspective of well-being?
Thanks for this question. You know, so I'm a maternal fetal medicine subspecialist. So my clinical work is mostly with things that are not well. People who come to see me are having something go wrong. And certainly there's lots to diagnose and there's lots to treat. But when we think about pregnancy and birth, this is not supposed to be a pathological event in people's lives. And so if we are free of pathology, we have not really won the game. All of us come from pregnancy, right? All of us were born. And if that experience is pathological and painful and negative, or even just neutral, that isn't really what we want to shoot for. And so I think particularly around the perinatal period, we don't just want people to get by. We want them to thrive. And I really look to Joya Kerr Perry, who's the founder of National Birth Equity Collaborative, who said, what would it look like if women didn't just survive pregnancy, but if they could thrive? And so that's kind of the North Star that we wanted to aim for in this paper, and that I think we should be aiming for in maternal health in general, because in life, right, we don't just want to barely eke by. We want to be well. And so that's why we really wanted to focus on that in this particular issue. And I by no means want to underemphasize the importance of treating folks who are sick. We need to do that. We desperately need to do that. And we'd like it to be the presence of joy, not the absence of sorrow as our goal.
Well, you certainly have the credentials to say it should be more than treating people who are sick, because you do a lot of that, as you noted. And it's interesting. I mean, you're sort of drawing something akin to the World Health Organization's definition of health, which is, you know, they say this is more than the absence of disease. And so this sounds quite related, and hopefully we can learn from them as well. One of the dimensions that you focus on in the paper is framing this issue as a community responsibility as opposed to a personal responsibility. Help me understand, if you could, why it is important, particularly in the context of perinatal mental health and well-being, to choose the right frame, or how should we think about choosing between an individual and a community responsibility frame?
You know, again, with my, you know, Western medical training, we tend to talk about the individual patient as the unit of treatment and the unit of diagnosis. However, it's very, very clear that the world we inhabit has a lot to do with how we feel and how we move through it. And certainly personal decisions can affect what resources one has, but a lot of this is not about whether people made the right choices. And I think there's a tendency when we talk about perinatal health to think about, well, if these mothers made better choices, then they wouldn't have blah, 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 blah happening to them. One of the frameworks I find really helpful is the Racial Equity Institute's groundwater approach. Listeners may be familiar with this, but the metaphor here is if I go for a walk in the woods and I see a dead fish in a stream, I might think, well, gosh, that fish made some bad choices and maybe the fish ate something it shouldn't have. And, you know, that fish should do better. If I notice that the pond is full of dead fish, I might think, well, gosh, maybe there's something wrong with the pond. And if all of the fish and all of the ponds on my walk are dead, I might think, well, there might be something in the groundwater. And very often, certainly in medical treatment, we take an individual fish approach. We tell the fish to quit smoking and the fish should swim in a different direction and it should stop, you know. But in fact, the groundwater is really, really powerful and important. And in perinatal health, a pregnant person who has a minimum wage job and has another minimum wage job and has an older child and has housing that has, you know, lead in the water and mold on the walls is not going to be healthy, not because they're not trying. And so we really need to think about those external drivers if we want people to be well. I also think it's critically important because there's a growing emphasis on screening for health-related social needs, which is critical. And if we're taking an individual responsibility mindset, if a pregnant person says, well, gosh, I'm worried I'm going to get evicted. The individual mindset says, well, what were you thinking getting pregnant? If you don't have stable housing, you shouldn't have done that. As opposed to how do we live in one of the wealthiest countries in the world? And yet there are people who are pregnant who do not have a place to live. Like the problem here is the culture, not the individual's decision. And I think too often we blame the mother for making bad choices rather than recognizing that people's choices are only as capacious as the options that they have to choose from.
So in that context, in your paper, you use the Vital Conditions for Health and Well-Being framework. Help me, if you could, sort of lay that framework on top of what it is we've just been discussing, and then we'll talk about what some of the implications are of using that framework.
Yeah, so in 2017, the Ripple Foundation convened a number of different experts and stakeholders to think about what conditions need to be in place in order for people to thrive. And it really is aligned with that World Health Organization definition that health is a positive concept. It is not just the absence of disease. So what would we need as humans to be well? And they identified these seven vital conditions. So they are a thriving natural world, basic needs for health and safety, humane housing, meaningful work and wealth, lifelong learning, reliable transportation. Then at the center, at the core, is belonging and civic muscle. And the concept is that if we belong in a community, if we have people that we feel like are part of our networks, and we come together and exercise our civic muscle, then we can ensure and strengthen those six surrounding vital conditions that are so important. I learned about the framework probably about a year and a half ago and was really intrigued. And as I was thinking about this health affairs special issue, I thought, my goodness, what if we took that framework and mapped it to perinatal mental health to illustrate how each of these seven factors are associated with mental wellness. So I was really delighted to be able to bring together my co-authors, including folks from the Ripple Foundation and folks who are working at the community level, to say, what would it look like and how might these particular drivers be important? And I think it's important because it really expands the network of individuals who should be pulling together. Because if we're talking about humane housing, and that is looking at things like exclusive zoning that limits the construction of affordable housing, there are people who are very passionate about that issue, and they're not necessarily calling up their friends who are passionate about perinatal mental health to say, hey, we all need this thing. And so I'm hopeful that this will spark some potential collaborations that are outside of the silos we typically operate in to say, well, gosh, everyone is going to be better off, whether they're pregnant, perinatal, or what, if they have a place to live. So maybe we should all be working on that.
So this, as you noted, there's a lot of attention to social determinants of health, a term that is a little cumbersome, and maybe we'll find a better one soon. But there is a lot of attention within the healthcare community about identifying these and then trying to address them. Maybe it would be useful for the audience if you just took one of those vital conditions and walked us through in a little bit more detail, what is the condition with more than just a couple of words, and how do you see the relationship to perinatal mental health? And I think that'll, again, listeners can read about all seven if they have time, but if we can just kick off one or two, they'll at least have a sense of what you were trying to do.
I think humane housing is a really important example. And I think it's a complicated one because some of the reasons that there's a housing shortage are because people who have big houses want their neighborhoods to stay single family neighborhoods with big houses. And so we all have a dog in this fight, I guess, for want of a better way of putting it. When we look at housing, housing insecurity and housing instability are strongly associated with mental illness in pregnancy and in general. It is also known that exposure to housing instability in childhood is one of the most powerful predictors of adverse childhood experiences and subsequent mental health issues. When a kid doesn't have a safe place to live or a secure place to live, that has profound consequences across generations. We also know that intervening on housing makes a difference. So there was a randomized controlled trial in Columbus, Ohio, that randomized people with unstable housing to 2 years of rent support and housing placement versus usual care. And they dramatically improved birth outcomes by having that support in place. Now, that's not cheap, right? Giving someone housing for 2 years is no small thing. And yet, if a baby is born preterm and is in the NICU at 24 weeks, we spend millions of dollars caring for that child in order to give it the best possible chance in life. And we need to do that. But if the baby is inside the mom and the mom is sleeping on the street, we're like, oh, that's too expensive. We do spend a lot of money on things in healthcare, just certain things. And so we need to be thoughtful about what things have the most impact or what interventions could be most helpful. I also think when we think about housing, I think a lot of the work that Matthew Desmond has done with his book Evicted and then his more recent book On Poverty, by America, where he notes the amount of money that is spent on the mortgage deduction, which I'm a maternal fetal medicine subspecialist. I don't need, air quotes, a mortgage deduction to be able to make ends meet. And yet we spend far less on housing subsidies for people who don't have a safe place to live. I like my mortgage deduction. Like, I'm happy to have that money. And maybe we don't have our priorities totally straight. Same thing comes up when we think about zoning. When we have single family zoning that restricts construction in communities and people can't afford to live there and they have to commute further, that is an environmental burden because they're driving their cars further than they need to. That is a cost burden on the individual. That is a quality of life burden because they're commuting 45 minutes to an hour to 2 hours to get to and from work. There are all sorts of downstream consequences of that. And yet the not in my backyard emotion is probably one of the most powerful policy drives in life, I guess. I don't know if that's an American thing or a global thing. But if we really, really want to make things better, there are ways to do it. We just have to decide that it's worth it to us.
So, of course, we just did a whole theme issue on housing and health, and so it's great that you picked this as your first example. And in essence, what you're doing, because we had a nice presentation of other dimensions of the relationship between housing and health in that theme issue just a couple of months ago, in essence, you're just taking that example and applying it very specifically here to perinatal mental health and saying we can go beyond saying there's a relationship between housing and health. We can actually say there's a relationship between housing and perinatal mental health. And then once we understand that, that gives us at least the opportunity to do things differently. It doesn't flow as night follows day, but it at least gives us a sense of what would be possible. Well, I'd really like to walk through one more of those vital conditions and then talk about how we go from here. We'll do that after we take a short break. And we're back. I'm speaking with Dr. Allison Stubbe about vital conditions for perinatal well-being. In the first portion of our conversation, we discussed the concept of well-being and the vital conditions framework, 7 elements of what would be needed for people to thrive and not just have the absence of illness. We talked about one of those conditions, which was housing related. Maybe if you could just give us another one. And as I noted before, our listeners can read the article if they want to walk through all 7. But I think the specifics are helpful for understanding why this is a useful exercise. So if you don't mind picking one more, I'll ask you to kind of give us a sense of what that is.
Sure. So I think I'd like to talk about belonging and civic muscle, which is the center of the vital conditions framework. And I think the need to belong, the need to feel connection is a fundamental human quality. And that is true for people who are pregnant and parenting, as well as people in all contexts. We know that things like group prenatal care can be a really powerful modulator of outcomes, particularly for folks who are living with limited resources or isolated. And so group prenatal care, support groups for folks with perinatal mood disorders can be very helpful in helping people to feel less alone. And I think the other thing that's really important is that they do create opportunities for mutual aid. So certainly, and we talk a lot in the paper about specific programs that address material needs that are fundamentally important. And if you are going to a weekly group with other moms and someone has a 3-month-old and you have a newborn and they say, I have a onesie that doesn't fit my kids anymore, let me give you this clothing. Suddenly you don't have to go buy a bunch of clothes for your kid. And so if you think of all of the stuff that ends up being accumulated during the parenting journey, handing that down to the next person is great for the planet because then we're not manufacturing more of the same stuff. And it also creates this opportunity for mutual aid and collaboration, which is really key. We cite a couple of examples in the paper, and one of the ones that's been really inspirational to me is Queens Village, which is a program in Cincinnati, Ohio, that was founded by Meredith Smith, who's one of the co-authors on the paper. And Meredith has a PhD in women's studies, and she was recruited to work on this collective impact program in Cincinnati to reduce infant mortality. And so she went to the communities that are most affected and basically sat down and broke bread with people and said, so tell me, what do you need? What would make your life better? And these moms said, we just need a place to be together and not be totally despondent and isolated. And so they have paint and sips, they have picnics, they do yoga classes, they get people together to do things that help them feel well and to be in community with other families. And this builds civic muscle. So civic muscle is about creating a movement and accountability to make an impact. The participants in Queens Village said, you know, we're really not happy with the care we're getting at some of these hospitals, and they're not treating us right. And we feel like as Black birthing people, we're getting different treatment than white birthing people, and that's not okay. And so the Queens created Mama Certified. All 5 birthing hospitals in Cincinnati now report their outcomes disaggregated by race in terms that were defined by the participants in Queens Village to say that this is what we're doing to try to address the disparities that exist and the inequities that exist. Queens Village helps the people who are participating feel better and heal and have connection, and it built the capacity to ask for change and to advocate for change. And so I think one of the things that's important is if we cultivate belonging and civic muscle, people may want stuff they don't have right now, and we need to be ready for that. But the reason we have a mental health crisis in this country is not because things are awesome right now. So I think that it also is part of Queens Village. They invited the Queens to review the applications that Medicaid received for mini grants to do enhancements and services. And so then the women who were being served said, yeah, this is a good idea, not so much this. So it's critically important that we be prepared to share power and place power in the hands of those affected if we're going to really build civic muscle. We can't say like, we're all in favor of civic muscle as long as you don't ask for anything that you don't already have. But I think that's how change really can start to happen. I heard Esther Perel quoted recently about, you know, are we in the midst of a mental health crisis or is there a reasonable and rational response to crisis conditions? And certainly not all mental health is because the world is not awesome right now. And if the world were better, we would have less mental health burden. And I think we need to recognize that.
Well, you know, what particularly stands out for me in your answer, we've published a bit on sort of community power, and it's difficult often for people to find a starting point in that. You think, well, changing power structures is really hard, and indeed it is. And yet it almost always begins with the creation of a community around an interest. And it may not even be a power-related interest. As you note, it may be an interest of having clothing passed from one person to another. But then you find sources of commonality, you create connections, and that gives you a voice that you want to exercise and can lead to power shifts. So this notion of beginning with community and using that as a platform for accountability is very interesting, and it makes sense that that's sort of the central condition of the 7 that are in the framework. As I move through your paper, you outline these vital conditions, but then you also start talking about what needs to change. And you've alluded to that a number of times in the course of our conversation, so I don't think any of this will come as a big surprise to our listeners. But you do actually start with a call to expand the outcomes we measure, which sounds very technical related to some of the big power conceptual ideas that we've been discussing. So tell me a little more about what you mean by expanding the outcomes we measure and why you think this is important.
When we set out to do this literature review, we were hoping to find papers about vital conditions that enable people to thrive in the perinatal period. What we found almost exclusively was vital conditions that reduce depression and anxiety symptoms, but not that get you past not bad into good. I think the exception was primarily in the economic realm, where I think economists are attentive to things like happiness indices and stuff like that. There's some interesting work about parents in the United States are less happy compared with non-parents than any other OECD country. And that's partly because we have very few policy supports for people who are parents in this country. But a lot of it was about not depressed versus depressed. And so I think that, you know, you manage what you measure. And if we are not measuring positive qualities, then we can't quantify what is working to make them more positive. We can certainly see people be happy, but that is not necessarily the level of detail that we want to really hone in and say, wow, this is working really well. In this area, we opened a new park and we provided programming and there's more green space. And we've noticed that everybody's happiness index has gone up, which demonstrates that it's having the effect that we want. So I think that collecting that information systematically is really important to be able to understand if the policy changes we make are accomplishing what we set out to accomplish. So that's kind of where that call is. And I'm torn between the sort of explicit knowledge that you can graph with a mean and a standard deviation, and then the tacit knowledge and qualitative, I see people smiling and being joyful where there was not that before, and that is very real evidence. And I appreciate that if one is going to go before Congress and say you should do a thing, they're going to want more than I have pictures of people smiling. So we need to have that data in hand in order to align with the qualitative pieces that are absolutely data, but aren't always given the due that they deserve.
That's really helpful. Thank you. Well, as we come towards the end, I want to note that in the paper, you make references throughout to reproductive justice. We haven't really touched on that directly in this conversation. So given the role it plays in your thinking and in the paper, I wonder if you could say a little more about that concept.
Reproductive justice is a framework that was developed by women of African descent, reproductive justice, back in 1994. And this was during the time period that the Clinton administration was working on healthcare reform, and there was a lot of attention to reproductive rights, fairly centered on abortion access. And abortion access is a critical piece of reproductive rights, but it is not the whole story. And so these women who came together said, well, yeah, someone doesn't want to be pregnant or has a medical complication and needs to terminate a pregnancy. Yes, that is important, but that doesn't get us to justice. And so they framed reproductive justice as having four pieces. One is the right to bodily autonomy. Two, the right to have a child. So that means access to infertility treatment, which is not covered in most states and is an out-of-pocket expense in most contexts. The right not to have a child. So that is access to contraception and pregnancy termination. And then the right to raise the children we have in safe and healthy environments. And this is a human rights framework that says these are the things that need to be in place if we are to have just, fair reproduction in a culture, a country, a place. We're very focused here on that last piece, the right to raise the children we have in safe and healthy environments. And it's not, there's the pursuit of happiness is in the Declaration of Independence. Healthcare is not. I would argue that pursuit of happiness is aligned with raising the children we have in safe and healthy environments, but you know, I don't know if that's what Thomas Jefferson had in mind. But I think that when we think about this as a right, it really shifts the responsibility because if a human right exists, then it is incumbent upon governments to guarantee that right. Like that's why we have governments. That's why we have institutions is to guarantee rights. And that's not necessarily the way many people think of the role of government. And until we recognize that that is a collective responsibility, there will be people who don't have those things because we'll say, well, that's your problem. You know, you shouldn't have gotten pregnant if you didn't have what you needed. So I think we really wanted to center that reproductive justice context. And earlier when I talked about screening for health-related social needs, the individualist, late-stage capitalist mindset of, well, why are you getting pregnant if you don't have enough to eat? Reproductive justice says, why is there hunger in a country with, you know, one of the 10 highest GDPs per capita on the planet? And so that's why we wanted to really elevate that perspective.
So it really ties back to this framework of vital conditions and the sort of the mapping of rights, which are collective. As you know, there can be individual rights, but they have to be guaranteed collectively. So it does start to sort of navigate the boundaries between individual and collective. That's very helpful. Thank you. Well, I almost hesitate to ask you this question, but I feel like given the worlds you navigate in, I think it's an important one. You present a framework of vital conditions. You've made multiple references to how dramatic a change it would be for us culturally, economically, personally, to embrace some of the dimensions of this. And yet, it's your writing, and so you clearly are of the view that these are important. So are you an optimist or are you a pessimist? Do you see the real underlying challenges associated with perinatal mental health and well-being as ones that we're making progress on or ones that you think we're slipping behind on?
I think I have been made optimistic by the growing attention to the challenges of perinatal mental health and more broadly perinatal health in general, and the role and importance of the mother or birthing person in that context. About 10 years ago, I started working in earnest on postpartum care, and I have said a number of times that in American perinatal care, if the baby is the candy and the mama is the wrapper, once the candy's out of the wrapper, we tend to toss the wrapper aside. I don't think we've fixed that, but that is no longer the default assumption. And the concept of the fourth trimester, the extension of Medicaid coverage through the full first postpartum year, has been a sea change in the last decade to recognize that mothers and birthing people remain significant and worth caring about when the baby is out of the wrapper. So that gives me some optimism. I do think that it's really important to think in terms of both the more technical solutions and then the broader movement piece. All of us have a stake in this. All of us have been babies. Many of us will become parents or aunts and uncles or be friends of people who are parents. And I think it's a pretty important metric of a society as to whether giving birth is a joyful event that is celebrated and supported or a harrowing exercise that people sort of hope that they survive. And if we want to be civilized with a small c, I think we need to be the kind of place where birth and parenting is something that is joyful and supported. And I'm hopeful that all of the attention and focus will get us there. And that's going to require some shifts in power. And that's going to require some people having some stuff that they share with other people that they don't right now. And that's not easy. And it's important. So I'm going to say I'm an optimist. Yeah, I'm going to say I'm an optimist.
I heard you trying to hedge your bets, but I won't let you. Okay, well, that's wonderful. I, too, am an optimist. I, at the end of many presentations, people will say, you said you were an optimist. You sound very pessimistic. But in fact, I think you've captured beautifully what the opportunities are here and those glimmers of hope that we should hold on to. And as you said more precisely, the shifts in how we think about these issues, which are the foundation for it. Dr. Stube, thank you so much for doing this work, for your commitment to the work, both as a clinician and through the research you've done. Your explanation of what it would take for us to have a more positive perspective on perinatal mental health is very valuable. And I want to thank you for being my guest today on A Health Podyssey.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you'll tell a friend about A Health Podyssey.